great pleasure to be at the EKGF and having this marvelous opportunity of doing research there in this excellent research environment. And despite the fact that I'm perhaps a bit the odd one out here working on late teens, and to most of you going back centuries or even millennia, I might seem as a contemporary China watcher or something when looking at the 19th century. In any case, what I'm presenting today is how I came to this project and what I'm working here at the EKGF at the moment. So this is definitely a work in progress. We were talking about this project 2 weeks ago when we were in a car to Barbara Hendrich's talk, and I think it was Terry asking me, do you have a conclusion to the project? And I said, well, not yet. I might have one in 2 weeks when I give the talk. It was very optimistic, and I'm afraid I have to disappoint you in this respect today, but I think I have a hypothesis, and that's something to begin with. So for those of you who are not China specialists at all, I will give a very brief introduction into the general background of Chinese drama in the late Qing, and then to Chinese drama in general. And for those who are not too familiar with Chinese drama in the late Qing, I give a little bit of context for that period, with some details about late Qing drama discourses or literary discourses. And then I will come to the topic addressed here, where you are all specialists, but I'm not at all. And I hope that this will somehow lead into an uplifting conversation in the end of the talk and the discussion. The starting point of my inquiry is perhaps best illustrated by two opposing statements about Chinese drama and tragedies. When I had an interview with the cultural critic Yu Qiyui in the 1990s already, he underscored that there has never been anything like tragedy in China, and he reiterates an argument that we meet quite often. Around the same time, the drama scholar Su Rongyu at the Drama Academy argued that, quote, Chinese drama has its formal roots in tragedy. And these opposite evaluations about the existence or impossibility of a tragedy in China have a long history, and they go back to the introduction of the concept of the tragic or the tragedy in late imperial China and in early republican China. Now, to clarify from the beginning, I'm not interested in solving this conundrum, whether there is a tragedy or not, but I'm interested in when, why, and how people start talking about this. It means that I'm following a new historicism approach of literary analysis, and I will adumbrate the discursive field about tragedies in China and identify its main parameters within this evolution, along which the notion is transfigured then in the local context. And this is very closely related to the notions of fate and freedom, which figure predominantly in discourses, in Western discourses about the tragedy in the West. So that's why how I came to the project. And I think these very simple questions, when, why, and how, sort of will lead us through the talk and the structure. As you all know, there is an ample plenty of explanations and interpretations of what constitutes tragedies in different times in the European tradition, and as a consequence of which recent scholarship has mostly decided to break free from the doomed sort of search for the holy grail of defining what a tragedy is. Terry Eagleton, in his recent attempt on tragedies, even states that, quote, the truth is that no definition of tragedy more elaborate than very sad has ever worked. Well, as this will lead us very far, and he certainly doesn't stop here, he discerns two camps over history, conservatives and radicals, talking about the tragedy. Tragedy would still both agree that the conception of tragedy turns on a number of distinctions, and here quote again, between fate and chance, free will and destiny, blindness and insight, historical and universal, the terrible and the inevitable, the truly tragic and the merely piteous, heroic defiance and ignominious inertia. So these are sort of the parameters within the overall Western, very simplified Western discourse on the tragedy. So fate versus freedom are the core and opposite parameters, which have been widely discussed, mainly in relation to the Greek tragedy, particularly in regard to Aristotle's Poetics, of course. And some of them have seen the Greek drama as labeled as a drama of determinism, with the protagonist being fully dependent on interventions of the gods and oracular commands issued on them, while others have argued that while the consequences of choices are still controlled by superhuman powers, there are still choices for the individual. So even that is contested. And then later, with the development of a philosophy of the tragic, centuries later, the focus of attention has shifted towards questions of freedom and the possibilities of the individual's exertion of will within insoluble conflicts. Now, reading through this vast literature on tragedies and the tragic through the centuries in the West, and then trying to make sense how this was applied, appropriated, mitigated, or emphasized in the comparatively scarce and fragmented discussion we have about the tragedy in China, one might feel like breaking a fly over the wheel, or sort of bombard sparrows with bullets, as we would say in Germany. But at the same time, from Voltaire to Hegel, Babette, Jasper, Steiner, you name it, we have a very long discussion about the existence of tragedies in China, also in the Western context, as well as the Chinese, which sort of underscores the centrality of this of the question. And we will look at this later, come back to this later in the talk, but we'll now start with giving you a little bit of background and giving some rays of light into the whole overall cultural climate and the drama reform in the late 19th century, and then into when and why the discussion of tragedies in China have become germane to modern Chinese literary criticism. And this establishing of this context will allow to explain the urge and necessity to discuss this among Chinese intellectuals, and sort of give the background to them the specific definitions of tragic freedom and will in the third, in the how part of the talk. So now very generally about, I don't know, I mean, most of you are probably China specialists and you know something about Chinese drama. The main features are it starts and then the end in the series scripts that we have. It evolves into a very lively culture in the Ming and Qing. We have many local drama forms. Peking opera developed comparatively late, in the late 18th century. We don't have any sort of drama theory. We have comments on drama pieces, but we have quite a large repository of these comments. But we have no classifications, no theory. And this is actually the case until today, and we don't have actually a real Chinese drama theory either. So I'm working with comments and fragments about this phenomenon. We have a general sense of internal and external crisis in the 19th century, which leads to cultural reflections about literary or cultural heritage, which you certainly all know. And in regard to reassessing their literary heritage, actually both China and Japan, or Japan and China in this order, embarked on a very similar trajectory of literary reform with only slight temporal shifts. I think the conventional narrative is that everything came from the West via Japan to China, but there's a much more simultaneous process. Much of it that was received was actually Japanese research or Japanese analysis rather than Western one. These are sort of the main texts from, just for illustration, which do not reflect the whole range of publications about redefining or inventing a literary history in Japan and then China, because we didn't have any literary histories before. but you can see, like, it starts in Japan in the 1880s or 1872. This is Chinese history of the Mongol and the Qing Chinese literature written in Chinese in reaction to the vocabulary books. Chinese history, while most other, the blue ones are the works which are redefined in Japanese history. And the main figure in this discourse in Japan was, of course, Suguchi Shuyo. That's just for illustration. But what's important for us is the main objectives of rewriting literary histories in Japan and China. They are written in order to create a strong literary heritage. They construct a progressive theological movement of literary creation towards enlightenment and civilization, where they are the point they are reaching now. And it was important to include drama and the novel, which were previously low art forms, as establish them as a high art, and then also promote them as the most effective tool to educate the people. I think that's all quite familiar. So within this context, a more specific discourse on the reform of drama also evolved, and again very sketchy. This reform led to the rise of a new form of shimpageki. This is a reform theater in Japan. And it contained sort of the drama reform, the following ideas and agendas. It was important to promote drama versus theater and emphasize the author now and the scripts against the usual practice of developing plays with actors and in practice. Define the essence of the new drama as a realist drama, contemporary, social, relevant drama in contrast to the old drama. As a reaction to this, the defenders of the old drama started an essentialization of the old classical drama to establish this as the indigenous and the true and pure form as a national drama versus these hybrid forms of the new drama. As a reaction towards this, then, the defenders of a new drama, but mainly the Western drama, not the hybrid forms of drama, started to denigrate the classical drama as feudal, backward, and reactionary, and sort of wanted to throw it on the dustbin of history. So that's sort of the general discursive background when the discourse about tragedies in China emerged, or in China and Japan. Also, I mean, this process led to the formation or the first appearance of Chinese tragedies who were written by Chinese, like newly produced Chinese dramas on stage, but they were actually not part of the discourse that evolved around the theory of a tragedy. So now we'd like to address the question why within this discourse of reconfiguring the cultural past, the tragedy has become such an important issue, and how this relates to redefinitions or definitions, or what role fate, freedom, figure play within these different strands of discourses. So now I come to the why part, which as I call defining the plot tragedies as the quest or the question. Now both Japanese and Chinese literary critics discovered that in Europe the tragedy as an originally very locally based Athenian dramatic genre has over the centuries been imbued with an overall cultural value as representing the pinnacle of European artistic creation. We have the well-known statement by Schopenhauer that it's the finest arts of all. To Raymond Williams, the cultural critic, it has become one of the symbols and most powerful illustrations of the identity and community of European civilization. And so as such, it has drawn attention from many non-European cultures who in their encounter with Western culture pose then questions like, is there something equivalent to tragedies in our literary heritage? Or do we, in the course of modernization, need to create tragedies as well? Or to have or not to have tragedies or tragic forms has thus become sort of a yardstick of measuring one's own position in a global cultural hierarchy. But to argue for or against having crowd release not only implied an aesthetic criticism or a review on contemporary heritage, but it also implicated essential verdicts about the disposition of the individual Chinese subject to be able to relate to the concept of tragedy and faith, freedom and will, or the tragic experience. So I start with some quotes from the Chinese context. Ms. Qian Zhongshu writes in 1935, "We are supposed to be fatalistic people. It's therefore curious that fate is so little used as a tragic motive by our old dramatists." While Xu Zhimo states pretty polemically, as he used to do, "The essence of tragedy is an artistic presentiment of spiritual crisis. And we Chinese, not having developed that art nor any adequate substitute, possess no means of fathoming our own tragic capability, or rather having never been aware of the reality at once beautiful and terrible of the soul, are proud that we have chosen, obviously wisely, a safer walk by shunning and ignoring it all." And he continues, "The conflict of will and fate, this is the material for the real tragedy. But Chinese people do not understand the meaning and value of tragedies because they don't have a vaguely similar experience of this." And finally, he now gives this lecture in Peking, at Peking University, in English to his Chinese audience. So this is obviously about the incapability of the Chinese seeing, realizing, or facing fate, as they argue. And Hu Shi criticized this lack of tragedies in Chinese drama, ascribing it to the hypocritical character of the authors, who deliberately distort reality. And Lu Xun, reiterating Hu Shi's point, explains this act of distortion by the cowardice of the Chinese people, who would not dare to face realities. And these obviously culturalistic and polemical interpretations of the Chinese are per se not prepared, neither prepared nor willing to assert their own will, but remain passive in order to avoid trouble. That's what Lu Xun says, to avoid laughing. As we can see from the rhetorics at work, this is not an innocent or detached debate. It's really a very hot issue and a passionate issue at heart to all, whether they support or disavow the existence of Chinese tragedies. So this passion, or let's say this uncompromising decisiveness, is not confined to indigenous debates in China, but it seems also Western critics discussing tragedies felt a compelling need to comment on the possibility of tragedies within an Oriental mindset or whatever, which with mostly negative verdicts, and again mostly in combination with general statements about the dispositions of Chinese. I leave a few slides here which I didn't go through because I think you are mainly familiar with the drama before. Well, it's just a little illustration. So these are quotes from Western writers writing about the tragedy in the West who felt compelled also to comment on the possibility of tragedies in China. I will not read them, these are just some examples. So this is, of course, related to the question whether China has developed philosophical thinking at all, because tragic, or the idea of talking about reflecting about one's own suffering is something that's seen as the birth of philosophical thinking in the West. We can find similar, but then also more diverse assessment of the tragedy in the Chinese spirit in literature about Chinese drama. So in comments on the dramas or literature itself. A very early Western account by John Francis David in 1837 has actually no qualms at all to separate comedies and tragedies in China, in the Chinese context, although he acknowledged that there is no terminology for it yet. against this, in the very first history of Chinese drama that I have found so far, which is written by a German, Rudolf Gottschall, in 1887, and it's much earlier than the Japanese accounts, He unevokedly claims, and I want to read this in German, so if you hear an English translation, because I just love this. Nirgends finden wir in den historischen Dramen das erhabene Schicksal, welches den, also in den chinesischen historischen, welches den Menschen erhebt, wenn es den Menschen zermalmt. Nirgends die echte Heldenkraft, welche auf sich selbst gestützt das Schicksal herausfordert, nirgends den Konflikt gleichberechtigter Mächte, dem einen echt tragischen Untergang der Sterbliche erliegt. Genau. Wie kann es aber auch anders sein in dem patriarchalischen Staate der Mitte, der nur eine durch den Bambus regierte große Familie ist? Mit einem Wort, es fehlt das Holz, aus dem man die großen Charaktere der Tragödie schnitzt. But then again, a magazine article of 1878 comparing Chinese moral sayings with those of the Greek tragedians, this article sees a great deal of similarities in their attitudes toward fate and is concluding that the ideas of right and wrong, of a superintending providence, of the reality of the future world, of future retribution, and of human duty has prevailed in both countries. And then also in contrast to the definite negation of tragedies in China much earlier in Europe in the context of the cultural climate of the 18th century, Chinese dramas have been labeled as tragedies, as Patricia Sieber has shown, and they were regarded as very fine pieces of high literary quality. And Yuhalda, he published the first translation of the origin of Zhao Shigur, as a Chinese tragedy. And he presented the story as a salubrious counterexample to what the Jesuits typically considered the pernicious novels and plays produced in Europe. And again, after contrasting this Chinese place to the monstrous farces of Shakespeare, Voltaire famously remarked that The Orphan of Zhao had nothing but clarity to recommend itself, and that it surpassed what had been ever written in France at the time. So what should be clear from these examples is that we are mainly dealing with culturalistic and polemical statements, along with identifiable agendas, why they were sort of presenting them, be it in philosophy or literary criticism. by frankly defining and essentializing the nature of these people behind it, which is making judgments whether they have the strength, the will, and the conceptual framework or mindset to endure tragedies. But it's also clear that by the turn of the 1920th century, the tragedy as a question has advanced to a crucial issue, and as Tang Xiaoping had put it, the promotion of tragedy from a historian's viewpoint constituted a crucial aspect of the modernizing of literary discourse during the late Qing, interjecting significant shifts in literary and aesthetic conceptions. Now, going away from this more general and culturalistic or general philosophical, which is actually not philosophical, but in the context of philosophy's polemical context, I would now like to look at how the specific discourses on tragedy in China emerged, how it was received, perceived, and what was the core elements identified in these descriptions of the tragedies, regardless whether they would say we have them in China or we have them not. It still says something about their understanding of the tragedy. Now, going back to the general context, we have these competing forms of dramatic practice at when the discourse emerges, and that is exemplified by these two images. This is Wu Jingruo, who was bringing big the great Xinhua tragedies from Tokyo to Shanghai in the early 1910s. And you have this iconic Mei Lan Fang, who is representing the traditional drama. This is sort of the hybrid Japanese Renmin Sipa's drama, Western drama form that is appearing in very different forms as Western or new drama, whatever it's the old drama, which both dominate stages through the 10s and 20s of the 19th century, like our period. So in order to, if we want to situate the different strands, discursive strands about fate, freedom, and will in the cultural and historical context, we need first to take a quick look at how the notion of tragedy was introduced in first China and Japan, and this is of course adapted to Michael Lux's foundational approach of trying to do a Chinese Begriffsgeschichte or conceptual history, and adapted to the project that you were mentioning early on. So my first part of departure was to look at how the term hikeki or beitu that was became the standard term in photography was introduced to first Japan and then Chinese. We can see this. Temporal shifts, simultaneous activities, or simultaneous activities. What we can see is that there's a much more complex process on the Chinese side, but a steady standardization into the term higeki beizu. This is due to the fact that the Japanese texts mainly introduced the Western tragedy as a new form, and then they use the form first Beijitsu and then Tarajiji in katakana, and then later Beiju. While in China, more foreigners and also indigenous drama forms were sort of incorporated as possibilities for translation in the process. but what we want to know here is how these texts explain then Tarajiji, Higeki, or whatever, and how this in relation to Western discourses, as this forms sort of background for the discussion on fate, freedom, and will. Now, the main text for the Japanese reception was a translation by Kikuchi Dairoku, Shuji Oyobi Kabun, which is a very influential piece, and it has long been held to be a translation of from the popular magazine Chambers, Information for the People, which was very popular in Britain at the time. But now we know that it's a combination of the Information of the People and from a section from the 1859 edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica and also Alexander Bain's English Composition and Rhetoric. So it's a mix of all these three. So it's an amalgam sort of popular wisdom, a contemporary British wisdom about the nature of the tragedy. What is important important to for us at the moment is that this very influential piece and also the master text of it, the Encyclopedia Britannica of the mid 19th century, both emphasize the emotional interaction of people in the tragedy, the effect of the on the audience when watching the tragic fate of others, or on stage when the hero faces death. And a quote from this is, tragic and comic effects differ in regard to the emotions of the mind which they excite. And a drama is tragic or comic according as such effects are produced by it. The pity troubles itself disturbed without elevation, the mind are driven out by the sympathetic participation in greater griefs, which raises while it excites the mind while contemplating them. It is to these emotions, which are and can be no others than pity and terror, the actions and characters which we call tragic appeal. No. So this is this text, Shuji Oyobi Kabun, which appeared in 1879. The second, I'm not going to all this, obviously, but the second major influential text is going to Kutai, which is an account of German drama. So the general meaning of German theater. And this is an overview on German modern drama and mainly an explanation of Lessing's Hamburgische Dramaturgie from the 1760s or something. Lessing, as is well known, formulated a new interpretation of Aristoteles by emphasizing the empathy the audience develops, Phobos, is fear for him instead of terror. And he introduced the bourgeois Trauerspiel as a new form, replacing the tragedy. And he also did all this in order to establish a national drama for the German drama, which of course all did tap into the aspirations held by the drama reformers in Japan. So this was a major source for them of a reception of educational drama. This is important to note as the first impetus for a discussion on the reform of drama in Japan and later in China was highlighting the educational function of the drama. And it was focusing on emotions that will lead to revelation and purification. And we can, if we think about the translation, which standardized as Higeki for Beitu, or Beitu for the tragedy, which is actually the songs of goats or something, it's much closer related to the bürgerliche Trauerspiel, the play of sadness, or which it would be. So it's quite a correct actually translation. So there was no distinction made between Aristoteles and Lessing, so to speak, in terms of the terminology, but certainly in terms of contents. And we will now look at the different interpretations and positions in what do they say about this tragedy or Trauerspiel. And by trying to discern certain shifts in discourses. And here we are coming to the speculative part, which I don't know much about yet, but hopefully we'll present in a convincing account, if it's not just for educational entertainment. And I said in the beginning, I'm starting to walk on thin ice here, so to speak. and this is the work in progress part, which is, as always, starting with a grand hypothesis. So we talk now about fate, freedom, and will. Now, we all know the poetics of tragedy have been established since Aristotle, while the philosophy of the tragic, addressing the questions of fate, freedom, and starts as a German intervention in the late 18th century, starting with Schelling and then Lessing and, Fischer and so on. It's mostly classical German aesthetic theories that are interpreting and defining what is essentially tragic. Schelling, starting the philosophical line of debate, established the tragic as a real conflict between freedom in the subject and objective necessity. So this is a dichotomy, with, of course, none of both winning over in the end. The willingness of the protagonist then to endure the consequences of his or her decision, it's mainly his, to go against fate is then the negative proof of a man's free will. So you have the free will to go against your own fate. For Hegel, the tragic hero is famously schuldlos schuldig, so he's guiltlessly guilty. By facing the collision of contradictory ethical claims. And then Schopenhauer develops an openly pessimistic perspective of interpreting the tragic experience as a recognition of pain, of evil being essential constituents of life. and all these sort of elements we will find again, but in different constellations in the discourses. Peter Sondi is a German, no, he's not German, but he writes in German, literary critic who wrote a seminal study, Versuche über das Tragische, Attempts about the Tragic, where he tried to unravel these different strands of argumentation, which I will not recount here, but he discovered a hidden structural moment, ein verstecktes Strukturmoment, in these, all these discourses, directed from Schelling down to Benjamin. Which is its dialectical or operatic structure. And he also discerns a certain diachronic shift of emphasis from fate to will in these discourses, which could be understood on a superficial level as a conventional trajectory from tradition to modernity, which would sound very plausible, but it's of course much more complex here. But also if we start with sort of two statements by protagonists who have been seen as the founders of tragic theory in China. Zhuo Renyue, which nobody knows, and Wang Guowei. If we sort of confront them, or let them talk to each other where they are 300 years apart from now. Zhuo Renyue, coming from a Buddhist context, is the first one to write about tragedies, or that's why he's called the father of tragedies in classical drama theory. Says he was life and you heaven poisons man, with death and tragedy heaven refines man. Well, I have a long quote, but maybe we don't have time to read it all. And then this is one of his very famous and most often quoted and famous statement about tragedies and in relation to the assertion of the hero's will, which is still performed through the hero's assertion of will.
And
so about 300 years lies between the statement and Zhou's comment is from the 17th century, probably around 1720. We don't know much about him, or I don't know much about him. I couldn't find much about him yet. And he's not very well-known in drama history, but he's writing this as a comment to the New West Chamber story. Wang Guowei's discussion of Sun Yan drama is well-known, and it's the first full-fledged discussion of tragedies, naming it tragedies, and he does this obviously in, or as is well known, in the context of Schopenhauer's understanding of the tragedy. And we'll come back to this later. So what we could see here is following the form. We have a sort of shift from fate to will. But I think it's obviously also again here more complex, so we have to start from the beginning how the discourse was introduced. The discourse about tragedies in China, certainly not in China, about like genuine tragedies, but San Francisco and Tokyo, with two texts, mainly lamenting about the lack of tragedies and emphasizing tragedies' benefit for strengthening the country and saving the nation. And it's in 1903, Ou Zhuzhang is the first one to address this, and he cries out for a creation of Chinese drama and tragedies that can revitalize China as it did in Japan and Europe. And Jiang Guanyun in 1904 reiterates his points and says, Napoleon liked to watch plays. Each time he was tired from politics, he went to the theater, and what he liked to watch most was tragedies. Napoleon said, tragedy is the high school for rulers and the people, whose benefits may be said to exceed those of reading history. He also said, tragedy can raise people's spirit, ennoble one's nature, and cause people to learn how to become great persons. And then he also adds that the lack of tragedies is shameful for the nation, as he has seen in Japanese newspapers, comments on the lack of tragedies in China, generally the Chinese drama being described as being crass and vulgar. He concludes that this is all very shameful, and only if theatre wants to be useful to elevate one's spirit, it has to be tragedy. So these are meanwhile familiar arguments to you, and it's not too surprising in the context we have developed below. However, Jiang Guanyun introduces a new element to the discussion, which I think we will play a role in the following evolution of a tragedy discourse around fate and freedom. As he says, when people within the same context of lamenting about the lack and defining its its function, when people become aware of the non-reality of the self and understand the vast supreme of Buddhism, their happiness also belongs to a type of tragedy. So with these two statements within one text, Jiang Guanyin's text can be said to entail sort of the two core elements of two separate discourses on the tragedy, or at least I see them as at the moment as two lines of argument. The first one is that a discourse evolves around the didactical benefits of the tragedy. And we've heard from Wu Shi, from Xu Zhimo or Lu Xun, that people are not capable of enduring or creating tragedies. But how exactly do they define these tragedies or the tragic? Now, Husserl starts this in 1980 by identifying three types of prejudice, with the third and most important being, and that's a quote, it is to acknowledge that if in every minute and walk of life there are moments of extreme tragedy and calamity. This is neither that heaven is not benevolent, nor a god of destiny making fools of people, but a society that is harmful, causing people grounding their will, degenerate in morality, sink into evil, and not being able to free themselves. So the tragic sort of conflict between the assertion of will against fate, or the conflicting, the conflict of equally valid interests, is here reduced to a conflict of the individual with his will against society. And this is taken up by Lu Xun, who comments that Chinese literati don't have the courage to face responsibility for their lives, for their fates, or at least for social phenomena. And he sees the reason for this in the strong dominance of rights over individual action in old society, or still prevalent as he sees in his contemporary society. Now, this is 1925, and in 1925 also Bing Xin, a dramatist, stresses the assertion of will, so we have a focus on the assertion of will as the driving force of the tragedy, but she also states that, quote, tragedy must describe an inner conflict, it's a seemingly conflict, it's psychological or inner conflict, but I think it's an inner conflict, and must have a tragic driving force, which lies in the recognition of oneself and assertion of will vis-a-vis a conflict. However, now her conflict is again, however inner this conflict and will might be, it leads to action as the ultimate result of the tragic experience. Because she says, one has a free will, has the freedom to push forward, to fight for gaining freedom, then tragedy is born. So, tragedy is interpreted, the assertion of will or the exertion of will is interpreted in a very clear direction. Of course, neither Lu Xun nor Hu Shi were looking at the Chinese heritage of tragedies of dramas as they were negating its existence, but to European models, and that was sort of their framework. And as we've seen, the introduction of the tragedy in Japan started with the explanation about Lessing and translations from mainly contemporary sources of 19th century Britain. This perspective on tragedy as bürgerliche Trauerspiel is reflected in these explanations, with its emphasis on social conflict, on individual bourgeois emancipation, and the didactic function to educate the people of a new nation, which also resonates in this Chinese discourse of nine. There's also another element to the seemingly superficial argumentation, as I see it, because the most important feature of both Lu Xun, Hu Shi, but also other May Force writers in attacking Chinese drama and the lack of tragedies was highlighting the dominance of the principle of the great unity in Chinese drama, the Da Tuan Yuan at the end of each play, which means the happy ending, so which are of course a general feature of most of the Chinese dramas. But if we, as we heard in the beginning, have as a minimum criteria for a tragedy that it has to end sadly, a Da Tuan Yuan, a great unity play, can per definition not be a tragedy, and that's what they want to argue for. But regardless that, we have actually a quite vivid discussion or criticism of this great unity of starting from the 14th century and going through the Ming, which we're not talking about here. For this moment, I would like to highlight that this attack on the Da Tuan Yuan is also related to the concepts of fate and karma, which the main fourth movement of fate and karma as a narrative structure, which the defenders of the main fourth movement would go against. Because as we know from studies from Victor Meyer, Stephen West, and others on Buddhist influences of narrative structures of popular literature, Since the Tang Dynasty, the most common plot was karmic retribution, and the resulting plots might have a didactic element guiding the reader, for example, the insight into emptiness or worldly attachments, and so on, or showing the failure to gain such insight with the consequence of remaining trapped in the circle of rebirth. So these attacks against the great unity of drama, which were explained as displaying the childish and blindly optimistic character of the Slavish Chinese people, they were also attacks on a narrative convention, which so the karma-driven plot engine of the classical literature, and it should be free from this circular, fatalistic, or karmic trajectory with Buddhist overtones into a linear trajectory of modern fiction. So this line of interpretation of this sort of school of thought of the tragedy from Muxin and Fuxi, in a sense, I would think in China led to that end, because for Fuxi, the tragedy should be the most wonderful remedy for Chinese literature because it reflected life in a true manner and it is most connected or related to life, which sounds like an odd interpretation of the idea of the tragedy. But at this instant, the discourse on tragedies confluenced with the protagonist, with the propagation of a new realistic drama and realism. That's what he's trying to propagate. So for Fuxi, as for Wang Guwei, the major strength of the tragedy lie in its ability to move and unsettle the audience. Here they sort of agree with each other. But this moving or the unsettlement, the Erschütterung, had very different ideological implications. Because for the cultural iconoclasts and politically oriented cultural critics, which I've quoted now, or which this is sort of one discourse, this Erschütterung, it gained a very definite and objective oriented dimension when it was linked to the purpose of inspiring the audience to revolutionary action. So that was sort of the ultimate goal of it. That's when they, Fuxi and others, argue that only realist drama is good drama and only tragedies are realist. This in fact paved the way for the theoretical exclusion of this drama in revolutionary literature, which of course doesn't know tragedies. And the peak of this interpretation is found in 1936 in a speech of Zhou Yang interpreting Shakespeare when he agrees with a Soviet literary critic, one of the rap critics, that in intentions, Shakespeare's in the context of his works and in their essential quality, he is a realist, using various dramatic forms and themes from comedy to tragedy and from tragedy to amusing tables. He has never taken objective reality for a mere reflection of the spirit. His basic roots are in the world around him, the world as it is, not a fabrication. And as we all know, the world as it is was defined as a world of class struggle in this revolutionary context. Realism conceived as restricted to revolutionary and later romantic realism, of course, excluded the possibility of tragedies. And that's sort of the end of the story from this argumentation. But now we can come back to the other one, which is a more complex line of argument, which can perhaps be called a philosophical one. And here we have to start with Wang Guwei and his seminal texts about tragic elements in the Hong Nom and Yuan dramas. So in 1904, same time when Zhang Guanyin published his article and mentioned some allusions about Buddhism, Wang Guwei came out with the first explanation about what he saw tragic in the Dream of the Red Chamber. He explicitly derives this notion of the tragedy from Schopenhauer, as he explains, and further explains his understanding of the relation between fate and will from his reading of Schopenhauer. He again starts with defining three types of tragedies, and also fibers, the third one, which are those tragedies necessitated not by evildoers or unexpected incidents, but by the characters' positions and their relationships. Positions and relationships that are common among common people. In this last kind of tragedy, those involved clearly know the harm of their actions, yet they still inflict pain upon one another, acting without shouldering any responsibility. this kind of tragedy is far more moving than the first two kinds. Why? It is because this kind of tragedy shows that the grave misfortune in life is not accidental, but inevitable. When we read the third kind of tragedy, however, we realize this kind of powerful tragedy capable of destroying happiness in life can take place in front of us any time. Moreover, we can inflict this kind of cruel tragedy upon others just as easily as it can happen to us. Now, within this statement, we can see Wanggawei's interpretation of the tragic as inspired by Buddhist thoughts. By emphasizing the core tragic conflict lying in a perpetuous desire, which can never be fully fulfilled. And hence, the aesthetic dimension of art lies in a disinterestedness that helps the individual to go beyond his will to live, and obnoxious secular desires, to enter a state of sort of serene contemplation. Which Wang Bowei calls Jingjie in his famous elaborations on aesthetics, which is another Buddhist term, but of course differently interpreted here by Wang. This Buddhist background, both in Schopenhauer's and Wang's interpretation of the tragedy, is important to know as it picks up on something that we've seen in Drorin Ye's comments about it all being destiny, but it's reconfigured in a modern perspective. And reconfigured the interpretation of the assertion of will, as we will see. Because here the assertion of will enables the protagonist to realize the vanity and let the will vanish. And this is further explained by Wang then in his Sumian Xu Ji Ka. And the main quote about, and here this is the quote about the assertion of will to the full in precipitating the calamity and facing it without wings. So Wang, it seems, resolves the dichotomy of faith versus freedom or will by introducing the idea of karma, even if not explicitly, but as fate and as liberation from it through the assertion of will. Karma plays a significant role also in Xu Jimo's reflections about tragic in 1923, when he says pure tragedy is an art expressing the conflict of contradictory phenomena suppressed by nature of life. Conflict between soul and flesh, between will and fate. This is the material for the real tragedy. And he continues, issues of art are issues of life. Art and life interact as karma, or as cause and effect. The further shift of interpretation is perhaps best illustrated with this last example I'm giving here in a polemic of Qian Zhongshu against Wang's concept of will and fate. Qian, beginning with a description of Chinese drama in a rather lapidary tone, quote, poetic justice is always rendered, and pathetic and humorous scenes alternate as regularly as the layers of red and white in a side of sticky bacon. To borrow a homely simile from Oliver Twist, he criticizes Wang for a superficial application of the assertion of will, as none of the characters would have any sense of inward or inner conflict. Hence, there is nothing more than personal sympathy one could feel with the protagonist. Quote, indeed, Wang Bowei's whole conception of the tragic as springing from the assertion of will seems definitely Cornelian. The tragic conflict as conceived by him is even less inward than that as conceived by Cornelian. And he's even more succinct in his criticism when it comes to the notion of fate in interpretation of the play Injustice to Dou Alien, which is sort of one of the masterpieces or to judge Chinese tragedies. Quote, in other words, the playwright has so presented the situation that the play is bound to end in poetic justice and not in tragedy. Why? Dou Huanyun perishes neither for any fault of her own nor by any decree of fate. The playwright's own sympathy is certainly with her, our moral judgment is with her, and even divinity of fate is with her. Test the drought and the fall of snow. Her mind is all of a piece. The assertion of one's will in such a case is a comparatively easy matter. So, Qian Zhongshu in his discussion is the only one to make a clear distinction between karma and fate, because he says, tragic fate has nothing to do with fatalism. In other words, our conception of fate is the equivalence of action and award, rather than that of cause and effect. It's not the ethically neutral idea the doer must suffer, but the sentimental belief that virtue is its own reward with additional rewards to be forthcoming. Thus, whereas the effect cannot be in disproportion to the cause, the award may quite conceivably be disproportionate to the action. We usually explain away this disproportion by a theory of metempsychosis. We either have old scores in a previous life or will receive compensation in a future one. This idea and the Greek idea stand as opposite poles. And while this might seem stating the obvious to you, it was certainly not in the context of the time, because when in 1933, Zhu Guangqian published what is probably the only full-fledged theory written by a Chinese on tragedy, as a book at least, The Psychology of a Tragic, he explains fatalism, like Su Ming Lun, is closely related to tragedy. It is probably the first explanation of the evil in the world. But he also says that fate, Mingyuan, is important for the creation and the reception of the tragedies. So he doesn't distinguish between fatalism and fate. But for Wang Guowei, fatalism is negative and passive, while the real tragic lies in the effort of resistance against fate, resulting in the overcoming of desires and hence a freed will. Qian Zhongshu, attacking Wang, has apparently already forgotten, or at least he dismisses, the whole Buddhist concept in his argumentation of fate and will, and hence has a sort of easy job of dismantling Wang's argument on a rather superficial level. While I would think he's completely misreading Wang. But here I should sort of come to an end, and what I hope to have shown is that both tragedy as well as its defining parameters have become a central concern, an issue of debate in late and early Republican China. I've also tried to unravel sort of different notions, different discourses around these central notions of fate, freedom, and will, showing that there's one interpretation that follows sort of the European, Japanese reception tradition based on the Bürgerliche Trauerspiel and the Master Text of Lessing, which pretty much closed the door for a series of more genuine appreciation of the tragic. But at the same time, the more philosophically inspired discussion of fate, karma against the Buddhist backdrop might, in contrast, open further avenues of explorations in this area. But as I said, this is all very hypothetical in the beginning. And so to conclude, while this sort of research is not contributing to the quest for do we have a tragedy in China, I think there's no reason to lament about anything lacking in either the Chinese spirit or its literary heritage, as we can indeed find quite a rich interest and discussion about these basic tragic elements, even if not articulated in these European terms. And in that sense, and for the structure of this talk, I think we can come to a happy end. Thank you.